The headlines: Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration temporarily freezes arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for review. And hundreds of Rohingya are reported missing from a refugee camp in Indonesia and are believed to have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf said the implementation of the legislation called the Strategic Action Plan is within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ghalibaf noted that the law has left the door open for Iran's return to full compliance once other signatories fully abide by their JCPOA obligations, including the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. The top parliamentarian made the remarks during a visit to the Fordow nuclear facility. He also criticized the other signatories to the accord for failing to live up to their commitments. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran that were lifted under the accord. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says his trip to Georgia is aimed at helping diffuse tensions in the region with the help of regional countries. In a meeting with Georgian President Salom Zurabichevli, the top Iranian diplomat said that he also seeks to boost cooperation with neighboring countries during his trip. Prior to his meeting with the Georgian president, Zarif laid a wreath on the memorial of Georgian national heroes in the capital, Tbilisi. During his talk, Zarif underlined that Iran and Georgia enjoy age-old relations and that the two sides have good potential to work together in the transportation sector. Zarif's trip to Georgia was part of his whistle-stop regional tour. The United States has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said the move is aimed at ensuring the sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. The frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 jets to the UAE. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to the dire humanitarian situation in the country. Political analyst Brian Terrell says the U.S. is concerned about its own strategic objectives rather than the lives of Yemenis.
Well, I think this is very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when President Biden was vice president of the United States. I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on, and not consideration for the people of Yemen who are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies, they make them.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington rejects Beijing's maritime claims in the South China Sea beyond what is permitted under international law. Blinken pledged to stand with Southeast Asian claimants in the face of China's pressure. He made the remarks in a call with Philippine Foreign Minister Teodoro Loxin. China claims almost all of the energy-rich South China Sea, which is also a major trade route. The Philippines, Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Taiwan have overlapping claims. China has time and again accused the U.S. of interference and increasing tensions in the region. Independent geopolitical analyst Brian Berletic says the U.S. view about international law is hypocritic.
Most of this started under the Obama-Biden administration. It only heated up under the Trump administration, but it's going to continue now that Biden is U.S. president, because this is all being driven by a singular U.S. foreign policy to encircle and contain China. And this has been ongoing for many years, you could even say decades, and this latest leg of it is also going to absolutely continue under Biden. And as a matter of fact, everything that we hear the now new U.S. Secretary of State saying about the South China Sea is just an echo of Mike Pompeo from the last 4 years about, you know, China overstepping its bounds and the U.S. backing Southeast Asian countries. It's also very difficult for nations here in the region, again, including nations the U.S. claims it's championing for. It's very difficult for them to take the U.S.'s involvement seriously and see it as sincere assistance and not just a pretext for the U.S. to maintain what it itself calls in all of its policy papers its desire to establish primacy over Asia. The United States is not an Asian nation, so why is it seeking primacy in Asia? This is very problematic, and of course it's very hypocritical when we're talking about international law and even international norms.
Hundreds of Rohingya have reportedly disappeared from a refugee camp in northern Indonesia, and the local officials in the city of Luk Semave say only 112 refugees from nearly 400 have remained at the makeshift camp. Indonesian authorities and the UN say they do not know the whereabouts of the missing refugees, adding that they might have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. The refugees had arrived in Indonesia last year. Members of the stateless minority group have long faced discrimination in Myanmar. They've been denied freedom of movement and citizenship and lack access to work, health care, and schools. Nearly a million of them crossed into neighboring Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown in 2017. The UN has described the plight of Rohingya as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. A team of the World Health Organization experts has begun a probe into the origin of COVID-19 in the Chinese city of Wuhan after leaving their two-week quarantine. The WHO teams wants to know how the virus that has claimed over 2 million lives appeared and spread worldwide. They are also investigating how the virus jumped from animals to humans. The team arrived on January 14th in Wuhan, where the first known cluster of virus cases emerged. In December 2019, the virus is believed to be originated from bats and initially spread from a wet market in Wuhan, where wild animals were sold as food. Stephen Ray is joining us now from Beijing. Stephen, what's on the agenda of this team from the WHO?
The big question that China is asking is what's on America's agenda? And that's, in China's eyes, is pretty obvious. That's to look for ways to blame China for the whole thing and muster an anti-Chinese coalition. The WHO should be sticking to the agenda, its own agenda, which should be, as you say, to find out where this came from and how it spread initially. And it's because this whole thing has been so politicized right from the word go that is going to be very hard to do. For example, the America, as I said, has been trying to muster a coalition to blame China for this whole thing. It's also been leaking information, misinformation, that it came from the Wuhan Virology Institute, even though there is broad agreement among experts, so that's very unlikely. And there's even been misinformation that China released this deliberately as a weapon. China has responded with its own campaigns of misinformation. It said that this came in from frozen food packaging and had been circulating in Europe since 2019, and it's even suggested that the U.S. Army laboratory at Fort Derrick in Maryland, which closed in 2019, is linked to this pandemic. More significantly for everybody else, it's been hampering the WHO investigation because it thinks this will be influenced and guided in a way that is against China, And it's also insisted that its own experts carry out the first phase of the investigation. So that's the information that the WHO experts will be working with initially, evidence and data gathered by China. They've already been talking to Chinese experts via video link, and now they'll have the opportunity to do so face to face. I mean, it's a bit sad that this, what everybody needs to know, what would really benefit the whole of humanity, would be where this came from and how it spread initially, because that, of course, will be of enormous help in preventing future similar epidemics, new viruses that may emerge, and containing them and stopping them spreading as this has done. But unfortunately, you know, America does have a record of politicizing and manipulating teams of investigators that are supposed to be independent and neutral. I hope this isn't stretching things too far, but I'm reminded of, you know, IAEA inspectors looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, it turned out that those teams included American agents, and they were demanding access to highly sensitive sites that had nothing to do with WEMD development. And when Saddam refused, which he had very good reason and was totally justified in doing so, this was taken as his, you know, evidence of his ill intent that he was hiding WMDs, and it enabled the US to influence global opinion and muster a coalition to go in and destroy Iraq. And after Iraq had been destroyed, it transpired that Saddam was wholly innocent, at least of the specific charges. But of course, that was no good to his country after it being laid to waste. So I take a very dim view of the chances of this mission being achieving its ends, finding out the truth when there is so much politicization going on, and America has this kind of record of using such an opportunity in very bad faith for its own political ends.
All right, thanks a lot. Stephen Rabe joining us from Beijing. Germany is preparing entry restrictions from travelers from Britain, Brazil, and South America amid growing concerns of more contagious coronavirus variants. According to the Interior Ministry, the new rules are being discussed with the government. Meanwhile, Germany's health ministry announced it expects the current shortage of coronavirus vaccines to continue well into April. The health minister said he wanted to call a summit of federal and regional leaders to discuss vaccinations. The death toll from the virus in Germany has crossed 55,000. The overall number of infections stands at nearly 2,180,000. Hundreds of people have been injured as the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli witnesses a third consecutive night of protests against a strict coronavirus lockdown. Lebanese media reported that 226 protesters and security forces were injured during the clashes. Security personnel fired tear gas and used water cannon to disperse the angry crowd of mostly youth who threw rocks and set garbage bins on fire in Tripoli's main square. Lebanese people are frustrated with the tight coronavirus restrictions. The government imposed a full round-the-clock lockdown earlier this month in order to curb the spike in COVID-19 cases. The pandemic has exacerbated the country's already crippling economic crisis. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says the mob tried to take over police headquarters during protests in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli.
We also had a group of people, a mob, trying also to try to go to the main headquarters, the main police headquarters in Tripoli. That was when the security situation seemed to get out of hand, and the army had to bring in more forces in order to secure the area. And then after midnight, basically, we had more calm. It was more peaceful. People went back to their homes. There were many who were injured, including, of course, security personnel who, like we said, had bomb grenades thrown at them. At first, they thought it was Molotov bombs, but then they turned out to be actual bomb grenades. So that was something that was very much worrying. And that led to denouncing from several politicians, including Saad Hariri, who does have a popular street, if you may say, in Tripoli, denouncing violence, denouncing vandalism, and any sort of violence towards security personnel and the Lebanese army. Now, this, of course, is the result, basically, of the fact that we have a huge economic crisis, which has been deteriorating since last year.
Amnesty International has called on France to halt weapons sales to Lebanon, citing concerns over human rights violations. The group said in a statement that Lebanon's security forces have used French-made equipment against anti-government protesters, especially since 2019. It said the excessive use of the weapons, such as rubber bullets, tear gas grenades, and launchers, has led to serious injuries. Amnesty International France said its findings are based on more than 100 videos, testimonies, and medical records as well. It urged Paris to ensure that there are no further sales of such equipment until Lebanese authorities acknowledge what it called their past violations. Iran warns Israel that it will hit Israeli cities and missile bases if Tel Aviv makes a mistake by carrying out its military threats against Tehran.
Israelis must know that if they make the slightest mistake, the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa will be razed to the ground on the basis of remarks made by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Based on the strategies of the Islamic Republic, the collapse of Israel is on the agenda. Iran and regional nations will not back down on their demand for the collapse of Israel. There is no way other than ousting the cancerous tumor of Israel from the region.
Abolfaz Shekarchi made the remarks after an Israeli general said the regime is refreshing operational plans against Iran. Iranian military official dismissed Aviv Kochavi's remarks as an illusion and psychological warfare. He noted that such remarks could also be based on the fact that Israel is not aware of Iran's military might. The latest Israeli rhetoric against Iran comes as a new U.S. administration has signaled it wants to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal. Tel Aviv has frequently threatened the Islamic Republic with strikes over its nuclear program. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshchezhm says U.S. and Israeli threats against Iran are hollow and boastful, and that any attacks on the Islamic Republic won't be left unanswered.
Now, after Tripoli incidents last year, shooting down the Global Hawk, and especially the masterpiece, which was Iranian missile attack on Ain al Assad, when the commander-in-chief of the United States, President Donald Trump, threatened to strike back 52 Iranian centers, and he never did that, then their hollow and boastful threats proved to be empty, hollow completely, without any credibility. So what should Biden do in order to advance this containment strategy? They have asked, at least for the past 1 year, they have asked the Israelis to step forward and to help them through posing threats to Iran, military threats to Iran, in order to claim that, okay, if crazy Donald Trump is gone, now the crazy Netanyahu is still there, and he would go for the military threats. But in essence, all throughout the last one and a half years, what have they been doing? They have been claiming that they've been striking Iran in Syria. 95% has been no more than lies. But for the 5%, they did something to Iranian allies. They have surely received their response. The Israelis remember pretty well what happened to them in the Golan Heights, and they remember the number of casualties they had in there.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Just near half of England's 59,000 vital flood defences are managed by a complex array of third parties, including government departments, local authorities, and private landowners. The figures show that 8% of those managed by third parties are in poor or very poor condition, compared to 4% of those overseen by the UK Environment Agency. In the picturesque district of Hart in Hampshire, all of its vital flood defences are managed by third parties, and nearly half are in a state of ruin. We now present you an article written by Josh Halliday. The piece is titled "Swathes of England's Vital Flood Defences Almost Useless." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Josh Halliday's article. An investigation has found thousands of England's vital flood defences were in such a state of ruin last year they would fail to protect communities from extreme weather. More than 3,400 of England's high-consequence flood assets, defined as those that there is a high risk to life and property if they fail, were judged by the UK Environment Agency to be in such a bad condition they were almost useless. This means that more than 1 in 20 of the country's crucial flood defences were in disrepair in 2019-2020, the highest proportion in years. This rose to nearly 1 in 10 in the regions battered by Storm Christoph recently. The findings come from Environment Agency data obtained by Unearth, the investigative arm of Greenpeace UK, and shared with The Guardian. Doc Parr, the chief scientist and policy director at Greenpeace UK, said, "The poor state of so many critical flood defences in England is putting thousands of people and thousands of homes at risk, and this is unacceptable. Most of Britain was placed under a weather warning for snow and ice after an Arctic blast of cold air hampered the recovery effort from Storm Christoph, which caused at least 600 homes to be flooded, as 2 months' worth of rain fell in just 48 hours in some areas of England." The Environment Agency said its 2020 recovery program inspected more than 20,000 assets and that they were winter-ready either through repairs or, if not, robust contingency plans are in place. It said that 95% of its 78,000 flood assets, which range from embankments to culverts and tidal barriers, were not in good condition and that repairs were prioritized when there was significant threat to lives and livelihoods. The Unearthed analysis found that 3,460 of England's most important flood defences were judged by the Environment Agency to be in a poor or a very poor condition, in 2019-2020. This accounts for 5.9% of the total, the highest proportion in years, up from 4% in 2017-2018. Of the 3,460, 791 were judged in very poor condition, meaning they had severe defects resulting in complete performance failure, essentially rendering them useless. The remaining 2,669 were in a poor condition, meaning they have defects that would significantly reduce their performance. Just under half of England's 59,000 vital flood defences are managed by a complex array of third parties, which includes government departments, local authorities, and private landowners. The figures show that 8% of those managed by third parties are in either a poor or very poor condition, compared to 4% of those overseen by the Environment Agency. In the picturesque district of Hart in Hampshire, all of its flood defences are managed by third parties, and nearly half are in a state of ruin. Experts have warned that the United Kingdom faces an increased risk from more extreme and unpredictable weather owing to the climate emergency. Major floods had been expected every 15 to 20 years in the last century, but in the past decade this has shortened to every 2 to 5 years. The Environment Agency has said it needs £1 billion a year to build and maintain England's flood defences, significantly more than the £5.2 billion announced by the government for 2,000 new projects up to 2027. Parr urged ministers to increase funding to better protect England's flood defences and stop building on high-risk floodplains. He added, "We know that the climate crisis is making our winters wetter, increasing the risk of floods across the country. We've had warning of the climate threat for years, so there is no excuse for not being prepared." In the Midlands, South Yorkshire and northwest of England, where nearly 600 homes were flooded recently, 831 of these vital defences are in a state of disrepair, 9% of the total. According to Environment Agency data, in Cheshire, where at least 150 people had to be rescued by firefighters, 16% of high-consequence flood defences are in a poor or a very poor condition. Dan Jarvis, the mayor of Sheffield City Region, said residents would have to ensure sleepless nights due to a £125 million funding gap in its flood defence allocation from Whitehall. Dan Jarvis welcomed an additional £80 million given to the region recently for flood management projects, but said this was a sticking plaster over a much bigger wound. He has asked ministers for months to fund 27 projects that would protect 10,300 homes, 2,800 businesses, as well as crucial infrastructure in Sheffield. A spokesperson for the Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs claimed, "We know how flooding can devastate communities, which is why since 2015 a record figure of £2.6 billion has been invested in flood schemes, better protecting 300,000 homes, and over the next 6 years we are doubling that investment to £5.2 billion for 2,000 new defences to better protect a further 336,000 properties."
got debate.
The U.S. President Joe Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have had the first initial contact, and there has been some strides made. First, an agreement on the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, cornerstone of global arms control, was reached. Russia has also reiterated a stance that the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal. Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at other issues that these two nuclear powers might share, like NATO and Ukraine.
Russia-U.S. relations have generally been tense, with their ups and downs since the end of the Cold War, dragging them into policies and sometimes even conflict. Now, a new administration in the U.S. offers a glimmer of hope, with all eyes now on the direction of the bilateral ties the two countries could pursue. In one of the initial moves to reduce tension, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin agreed to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for 5 more years. The agreement was failed to materialize under former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration insisted on a conditional renewal of the accord, which Moscow rejected. The Obama-era agreement puts a limit on the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles, and bombers Russia and the U.S. can deploy. The Russian president hailed Washington's move to extend the New START. However, he warned that the situation could still develop unpredictably.
The extension of the START Treaty is definitely a step in the right direction. But I repeat, the situation can develop unpredictably and uncontrollably if, of course, we do nothing to prevent this from happening.
The treaty, which was due to expire on February 5th, provided a rare opportunity for compromise between Moscow and Washington. However, the first phone call between Biden and Putin showed their bilateral disagreements are too wide to resolve. During the call, Biden raised concerns over what he called aggression against Ukraine and warned about Russia's meddling in 2016 U.S. presidential election. He also addressed the reports of bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and recent massive cyber hack that has been blamed on Moscow, accusations that Russia has categorically denied. The conversation also included recent protests in Russia in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. This is while the Kremlin accuses the U.S. of promoting anti-government protests in Russia and interfering in its domestic affairs. Following the phone call, the White House, in a statement, reiterated the tough U.S. stance on Russia.
President Biden made clear that the United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us or our allies.
The Kremlin also issued a statement about the conversation between the leaders of the two countries that underscored troubled relations as well.
President Putin noted that the normalization of relations between Russia and the United States would meet the interests of both countries, and, taking into account their special responsibility for maintaining security and stability in the world of the entire international community.
Can one expect a reset in U.S.-Russia relations while the Biden administration has already inherited thorny ties put in place by his predecessor, even with Washington's close allies? The world will be waiting and watching how Washington and Moscow manage their many differences and seek common ground to avoid escalatory confrontation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate is Richard Black, former Senator, Virginia State Senate, who joins us from Ashburn. We'd also like to welcome Daniel Kobalik, who's an author, lecturer, and lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Black, let me first start with you. So you have this phone call, and you have this initial contact between Putin and Biden. And, well, they had failed to agree an extension under former U.S. President Donald Trump, and I'm referring to the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. What did happen? What happened under Biden to have this come back that Trump rejected? What were the reasons?
Well, I think, first of all, the extension of the nuclear treaty was obviously a very positive thing. The Russians didn't ask for any preconditions. They just said, let's continue it and let's talk. I think it was a very wise decision for the Biden administration to say, yes, we will look and we will work towards extending it. One of the problems, I supported some things Trump did, I opposed others. I was not a fan of Mike Pompeo. I saw him as less of a diplomat and more of a bully. And his objective was to simply dismantle all of the nuclear treaties that were worked on for decades and decades by generations of good-hearted Americans and good-hearted Russians. So the fact that we're able to hang on to that one treaty, I think, is a very positive thing. Now, in the same conversation, you know, Biden, he is subject to pressures from the deep state, from all of the corporate interests in war. And so he, you know, he talked about the Navalny poisonings or alleged poisonings, and he raised those issues. He raised some other issues, which will keep the deep state satisfied that he's not going to be too friendly. But I think at least there's reason for some hope and some optimism. There certainly is good reason to see improvement in our relations with Iran. And I think to some extent, you know, the Obama administration continues to live on in some fashion. And they saw the JCPOA as being a very major development for them. And I think there's at least a hint that may still be in the works.
Okay, well, we're going to, you touched on a number of issues there. We're going to break those down one by one if time allows us. So, Daniel Kovalik, let me come to you regarding NATO first. In no order of importance here, Biden sought to repair the strained relation that was between the U.S. and Europe by stressing Washington would abide by the NATO treaties, Mutual Defense Pact. Now, do you think that this means that the U.S. is going to continue doing what it's doing with NATO, in which Russia sees NATO as an entity that's encircling it, while at the same time provoking Russia with things like war games?
Yes, I do think that. I think NATO is a relic of the past. It should have been dismantled some time ago. I think Biden's statement that he plans on honoring the agreements with NATO does suggest exactly what you're saying, that Biden plans on continuing to poke the Russian bear, to surround Russia. NATO exists for one purpose and one purpose alone. It was created to counter the Soviet Union. It's been used since the collapse of the Soviet Union to try to counter Russia, and that's what it's going to continue to do, and Biden's making it clear that that's will continue.
Okay, so let's continue the path of NATO, Richard Black, in the form of Ukraine, in terms of having your input here. I'm guessing that Biden is going to want to have some kind of settlement or peace settlement on Ukraine. Of course, that issue is very contentious in terms of how he has said repeatedly that he wants to expand and possibly include, wants NATO to expand and possibly include Ukraine in that picture. How do you think that situation is going to evolve under Biden vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine?
The main thing that has made it awkward for him is the involvement of his son, Hunter Biden, in some very questionable financial arrangements with Iran. Hunter Biden was just sort of the tip of the iceberg. We have very powerful politicians in Congress whose family members have acquired enormous wealth, and much of that wealth has been by being involved in these never-ending wars, where the United States constantly appropriates money to DOD and CIA and State Department. That money is funneled unaccountably to different companies, and in some cases we see it working its way to people like Hunter Biden. So there's a tremendous vested interest in war. War is our business, and business is thriving. And so it's awkward in Iran, or rather in Ukraine, because We toppled the government in Ukraine some years ago, and we said, well, we're after democracy and so forth, but in fact, we really were looking for conflict and for moving that conflict much closer to the Russian border. But the whole idea of NATO, I certainly agree with your other commentator today. Russia outlived its usefulness and should have been abolished. They should have had a little march and given a medal to everybody in NATO and simply disbanded it at the end of the Cold War. When they didn't, they had to have an enemy. And even though Russia was not an enemy in any respect, it did not have an expansionist philosophy, it didn't have the economic wherewithal to threaten anyone, didn't have the population to do it, and yet it was very necessary to create this boogeyman to justify the tens of thousands of deep staters in NATO and to perpetuate the idea that somehow we had an enemy. We don't have an enemy. Russia is not an enemy. And the only thing that creates hostilities is the fact that we are edging troops right to the very borders of their territorial waters and land, and threatening Russia in a very, very dangerous way, reckless way.
So what about another issue, Daniel Kovalik? Again, one of many that was discussed between these two. And that's the issue of Iran. We know Russia's stance, how it stands on that. I'm not too sure if we understand U.S.'s stance, somewhat murky. But how do you think that Russia would, or how would the U.S. and Russia cooperate with each other when it comes to Iran, even though that is somewhat a moot point because Iran has made its stance very clear when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, my hope is that Biden will re-enter that nuclear deal. Iran's made it clear they're willing to do it on day one. I think that will bring back down the temperature between the U.S. and Iran, and frankly bring down the temperature in the Middle East, so I hope that that happens. I think, though, that Israel and Saudi Arabia will be opposed to that, and we'll see if Biden is willing to stand up to those two countries. Trump was not. It's kind of the tail wagging the dog there, and I think it does remain to be seen whether Biden has the fortitude to do that. But I have some cautious optimism that he will, and that he is willing to work with Europe in honoring the nuclear deal, which, you know, Europe is still a party to. So, yes, I have some hope.
You had said, Richard Black, just minutes ago that you don't really see Russia, if I understood you correctly, to be the threat that it's been perceived to be, something that has been somewhat formed by the way that EU views Russia, perhaps, countries like the UK. And Russia, of course, has been accused of doing some things to make that scenario or to create that scenario. But we're looking at Biden, who once called Putin soulless. I mean, do you think that Biden will approach Russia in an offensive way in terms of dictation, or will it look it to be somewhat of an ally, which is very hard to actually conceive?
It is almost impossible to make an ally of Russia so long as we have this vast, deep state of NATO operatives in place. All of them, their jobs, their wealth, their position, all depend on having an enemy. And so that is the problem with truly forming an alliance with Russia. In a world without NATO, there is no reason that Russia could not join and become an integral part of Western Europe. Their values are similar. In fact, their new constitution provides that marriage is one man and one woman. It provides for parents' rights over the upbringing of their children. These are things that Americans have struggled to get for generations and couldn't get, and yet they exist in Russia. Russia is totally compatible with Western Europe. They're trying to extend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany. Germany wants it very badly. Russia wants it very badly. The United States is sanctioning and going contrary to the countries of the European Union on this issue. I see a very natural, very comfortable relationship if we were to drop the militarization. Some people say, well, look, Trump achieved something great because he got the NATO countries to increase their defense spending. For what purpose? Now, I can see some concerns about threats from Turkey, but I do not see any threat from Russia. Russia is no threat whatsoever to Europe, and the whole thing is just a piñata to give us something to strike at.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, we talked about NATO here, we talked about Iran, we talked about Ukraine, but then we take a look at the issue of Navalny. Now, you know, when Russia has come out accusing the U.S. directly of backing demonstrations and protests for Navalny, then obviously that rattles the cage of Putin in a sense, if he does have a cage, and that's, you know, in a sense, an interference, if I'm correct to make that assessment. So it doesn't make grounds for what the Kremlin wants, which is a normalization of relations between Moscow and Washington. That's something the Kremlin has come out and said. So is there a limit as to the way these two countries are going to get along when you have the U.S. been accused of it, which, well, it has been accused of this accusation in other countries, which holds true?
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S. claiming that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, which, by the way, I feel is a dubious claim, is at best the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, the U.S. has interfered, we know, in, 81 different elections throughout the world. This has been documented. And that doesn't even count the times that the U.S. has actually overthrown governments by force and by coups. So, yes, I would not be surprised if the U.S. Was supporting these demonstrations. They're clear from the media that I listen to every day that they support Navalny, even though, frankly, I've seen some statements by him that suggest he's a right-wing racist. But again, that's not surprising. The U.S. backed neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know, so. But yeah, as long as the U.S. decides it can meddle in other countries like Russia, but then takes umbrage at countries allegedly interfering here, I just think it's not a grounds for a mutual relationship.
There are other hot spots that these two countries need to figure something out on, Richard Black. One of them is Syria. They need to come to some kind of understanding on that. And of course, when we talk about West Asia, or Middle East, as it's called, then there also needs to be an understanding there, because Russia does not share all common interests with the U.S. when it comes to this region. How will that be resolved? And we could start by talking about Syria.
You know, the most insightful thing that I saw was put out by Atlantic Council not recently, or rather recently. Atlantic Council is very much a deep state organization, but their analysis was good. And they said that a couple of things. They said Tony Blinken, who is the proposed Secretary of State, has said that public support for U.S. hegemony is diminishing. He suggested that, at least in the short term, Russia and Iran will control the trajectory of events in Syria. Now, he did say that he was going to increase aid to the areas of Idlib province and the Kurdish-occupied northeastern Syria. Now, this means that we will be providing additional enhanced aid to al-Qaeda and to the terrorists that occupy Idlib province. Unfortunately, one of the saddest things is that we have had a consistent policy of starving the Syrian people. Through our sanctions and through devaluing the currency through the SWIFT system, we've created enormous inflation. We have cut off the Syrian people from their major source of wheat that they need for bread. We have stolen their oil, which they need to heat homes in the winter. We've even managed through our extensive sanctions to block the Syrians from receiving medicines to treat cancer and other diseases. Anyone who says that sanctions are designed to simply, twist the arms of wealthy, powerful politicians is a fool. Mm-hmm. The purpose of sanctions is to crack down on common people, and that's what they do.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to end it there. That was Richard Black, former senator at Virginia State Senate. Thank you for your statements. And also, Daniel Kubalik, thank you, author, lecturer, and lawyer from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikoa Tavley, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
حادثه قدیر پیش آمد، مرحوم تبرسی در مجمع البیان دارد، مرحوم علامه امینی هم در القدیر دارد.
Both the late Tabarsi in the book مجمع البیان and علامه امینی in the book القدیر narrates that when the event of قدیر took place, a person by the name of نعمان بن حارس came to Prophet Muhammad and said, O Prophet of Allah, why have you selected Ali as your successor? If it is your personal decision, I do not accept it. However, if it is Allah's decision, I cannot bear such a decision. Then he said, I'm ready to die, but do not see Ali as your successor. Now, some say that Surah Al-Mi'raj was revealed over here. Nu'man ibn Haris was ready to accept Allah's chastisement, but not Allah's order. It is narrated that he was chastised by a stone and died on that moment. This is where the haste of a human in getting the answer to his request will become an ill wish and perishes him. Now, dear brothers and sisters, we are asked in the narrations to have tasabbut or preciseness and deep thinking. Before our good wishes are changed to ill ones, we have to ponder more and do not hasten in getting the answers to all our requests. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.